I would say much denounced and generally loathed is probably closer to the mark, Alex. Well, ladies and gentlemen, as you can all see at the top of my voice, I am from the north of England. I've been in the US since 1970, but it's not rubbed off. Somewhere about in the late 60s, my twin brother and I came to the conclusion that all was lost in Britain. And so we decided to bail out, and we did it by going to business school at Stanford in California. And his case actually took, and he became a real person and still works on Wall Street. In my case, it didn't take, and I sort of reverted to this half world of financial journalism. I was lucky, I caught a great boom in financial journalism that went on for the next 40-odd years, coming to a screeching halt around about 2008. Now, what I do is, you know, one of the things that's happened in journalism in the US, and I'm sure in Britain, is the internet has made possible the disintermediation of journalism. We no longer, writers no longer have to work through big corporate entities. They can find their audiences directly. And that's what we do. We have a small foundation here in the Connecticut Berkshires. These are mountains, ranges of hills to the north. To the north and to the east of New York City, where we live. And it publishes the webzine, vdare.com, which is dedicated to providing facts analysis on what I regard, what we call America's immigration disaster, which was a subtitle of my 1995 book. I guess I want to make four points about America's immigration disaster. The first is that it's an extraordinarily big deal. Immigration to the U.S. is not continuous. It's gone through tremendous fluctuations going back to colonial periods. For long periods of time, there's no immigration at all. For example, in this area where I'm speaking from, New England, after the initial great migration of Puritans from East Anglia and so on, in the 1620s, there was no immigration at all. Until the 1840s, the area grew immensely through natural increase, but there was hardly any immigration. And similarly, there was a huge pause in the middle of the 20th century, in that case legislated. There was a cut-off of immigration in the 1920s, and that lasted until the late 1960s. The immigration law was rewritten in 1965 to allow a great influx of immigration, which nobody predicted. Lucia, am I doing something wrong?
No, sorry. It's me.
Okay. And at the same time, the Americans quite mysteriously stopped enforcing the law against illegal immigration. There had been a great influx of illegal immigrants in the early 1950s. It was ended in very short order after Eisenhower came to power with his so-called Operation Wehrmacht. They deported about 1.5 million people went back to Mexico. Only about 200,000 were actually deported, but the rest just got the message. That's something that's worth remembering when you hear about what's going to happen. How can we get rid of deport the alleged 12 million, probably 20 million illegal immigrants that are in the US right now? Now, it's a very big deal because, in effect, the government is electing a new people. Because immigration in the US is almost entirely from non-traditional areas, that is to say, it's very hard to immigrate from Britain, as I'm happy to tell you at great length, because that's very difficult for me. But there are tremendous, more or less unchecked flows from various parts of the third world because of the way that the so-called family unification principle works. And that's having a dramatic effect on the racial balance in the country. In 1960, the US was 90% white, about 10% black. Other minorities are just not significant. Now, somewhere about 2040, the US whites will go into a minority in the US. And that's not because they're not reproducing. They are reproducing quite happily and replacing themselves. But what's shifting the ethnic balance is this great influx of third world immigration. So it's a transformation without precedent in the history of the world. It's never been a case where a country's actually set about re-electing and reconstructing itself, reinventing its people like this. There are parallels, of course, because to my great amazement, this now seems to be happening in Europe, as I'm sure you know. So that's the first point. immigration is a huge deal. Now, the second point is, and I come to this as a financial journalist, and I got it when I started a research on my immigration book, which came out 20 years ago now, I effectively wrecked my career. I was fascinated to discover that, contrary to what you would read in the Wall Street Journal and all the various allegedly conservative business media outlets, the consensus among labour economists was that there was no benefit, there's no benefit in aggregate to native-born Americans from this enormous influx. It wasn't benefiting at all. What immigration does do, however, is it causes a great shift, a redistribution of income within the native-born community. In the US, it's estimated that it's somewhere between 2 to 3% of GDP is transferred from labor to capital. And that explains the class nature of this race in the US. It can be actually explained in very crude Marxist terms. You know, the owners of capital are basically oppressing the working class. It's as simple as that. If Bush had been able to get through the amnesties that he was trying to get through, the concomitant immigration surge he was trying to get through, and enormously increased the labour force, that would have simply had an effect of depressing wages more, and that would have been a great windfall profit to the owners of capital. And that explained why there was so much money on the other side in the immigration wars through the orcs every time they tried to get these amnesties through. We were just overwhelmed. We had no money at all, and they had all the money in the world. It just didn't work for reasons which I'll come to in a minute. You know, when I've been involved in Republican politics. I was a conservative, a member of the Monday Club, actually, University of Sussex, and that's when I knew John Ormond. And I joined the American Conservative Movement when I came to the US. In fact, in some respects, I emigrated to the American Conservative Movement. And I spent the next 30 years arguing with liberals who would say, you know, conservatism is just a racket, it's just a way to oppress the workers, it's a way to convince the workers to vote for policy which disadvantages them economically, you know, and it's really just a capitalist racket. But about 10 years ago, it dawned on me that at least since its immigration problems were, you know, they were right. Traditional conservatism has become a racket, and it is aimed at oppressing the American working class, and I also think it's aimed at oppressing the working classes in Europe, immigration policy. I guess the third point I would make is, you know, why is this happening? I mean, there's several reasons. One is that it just literally benefits people. So there's a class of people, big donors, it benefits a great deal. And there are various ethnic agendas, particularly in the US at work. People who don't like living in a white Christian society and want to see it transformed, or they want to see more of their own people come in. It's quite common for ethnic activists, Asians and Hispanics and so on, to openly call for more. They're allowed to do that in American politics. Nobody ever criticizes them for it. The only people who get criticized are whites if they were to do the same thing. Whites, of course, meet people who until 1965 we would have referred to as Americans. But the real issue here, I think, is that currently the most important issue is that there's a very clear political agenda. Essentially, the Democratic Party, the left-wing party in American politics, has simply given up on the working class. They were very badly burned by their defeat by Reagan, and the grip that the Republicans had on the presidency, really off and on over the next 30 years. And they've simply stopped trying to convince the white working class, or the working class at all. They just simply want to replace them. And they openly say this. Because of the nature of American media, they never criticized for saying that, you know, Texas, where my wife is from, is going to become a blue state, which in American parlance weirdly means a left-wing state, because of quote-unquote demographic change. That's immigration. It's not happening because of the differential birth rates of Texas. It's because the borders have collapsed, and there's a tremendous influx of people from South America coming in, demographic change. So that's the agenda that the Democrats are relying on. And if Hillary has made it very clear, the Democratic Party has moved very sharp to the left over the last 8 years. They're making it very clear that if they are elected, if Hillary does become president, she will immediately move to amnesty 12 to 20 million illegals who are here. She will increase immigration in various ways. She will cease enforcing the law at the border even more than Obama's already ceased doing it. And she will use executive for amnesties, this very broad interpretation of the executive power of the president to let more and more people become citizens, come in and become legal and become citizens because they want them to vote democratic. Now, you know, anyone who gets involved in the immigration debate, critically, is going to be called a racist. That's simply a rule of American life, it's a rule of life throughout the Anglosphere, probably throughout the First World. Well, the real issue here is not, it seems to be racism, but treason. I mean, how treasonable can you get that openly say you intend to outvote the native-born Americans? People who've been here and traced their roots back to the 17th century. You're going to do it by bringing in foreigners who they don't want you to bring in. And you're still going to do it by executive order. You're not going to have a direct vote. You're just going to bring them in there. Anyway, so that's what my ultimate conclusion on all this is, that we would just, for some reason, have a treasonous elite right now. And it's just simply determined to remake America, and of course it's determined to remake Europe. And the reason for that really bears a lot of thought. Now the final point I want to make is, you know, there's a concept in American politics called Stein's Law. Has anybody ever heard of this thing, Stein's Law? Is it known in England? It's named after the former chief of economic advisors for Richard Nixon. His name is Herb Stein. And if you're interested in the stock market, this is a very important concept. He said, promulgated the law, his rule of law was, things that can't go on forever don't. And that's a very important concept in markets, because very often they don't clear very quickly. And we sit around for years waiting to clear, and we think they're never going to clear. This is when you see all these articles in the financial press saying it's different this time, you know, the market's going to go, it's never going to break, the market's going to go to new heights. A permanently high plateau was what a famous economist called stock market in 1929. It's a move to a permanently high plateau. Of course, that proved disastrously wrong. Well, this is true in politics too. Things that can't work for don't. And what's happened here in the US is it turns out that the American voters really don't like what's being done to them. And because their traditional leaders in the Republican Party have not been responding to that, they found somebody who says he will respond to it. And this explains the extraordinary rise of Donald Trump. I mean, absolutely nobody whatever in Washington, anywhere, left or right, thought that Trump was going anywhere when he declared. We had a writer, Matthew Bagel, who wrote a piece for me, predicting that would run on immigration. And I ran it, but I frankly didn't believe it. I thought it was a good argument, but we've seen so many good arguments, and they never seem to pan out. This has panned out. They've hit Trump with everything they can. Hillary's already spent $50 million against him. And yet, you know, he won the Republican nomination overwhelmingly. And he's still, right now, you know, they keep thinking he's going to collapse in the polls, but he's not. His polls are every bit comparable to Romney. So we'll see what happens there. You know, the power of this phenomenon, you know, it can't be understated. I don't know whether Trump will turn out to be Reagan, who everybody thought was crazy and mad, and that was all the things that you hear said about Trump were all said about Reagan, if any of you are old enough to remember that. I remember in 1979 trying to persuade, I was then working on the Hill, I worked for a US senator, and I tried to persuade a Canadian journalist I knew to write something about Ronald Reagan, who just declared for the presidency. And this guy said, Reagan's going nowhere. He's one of the big liberal journalists in Canada. Reagan's going nowhere, it's going to be Howard Baker or something like that. Of course, this turned out to be disastrously wrong. And it only became apparent that Reagan was going to win in a historic landslide, actually on the night of the election. Until that very last moment, people didn't believe that he was going to get so big or that he would take the Senate. We could well see that happening with Trump. There are real seismic shifts going on in the electorate that's going to be very hard to predict. On the other hand, he could be Goldwater. What I mean by that is that I've never seen the political establishment so united against a political candidate, and included substantial members of his own party. Since Goldwater ran, you know, Rockefeller and several Eastern governors openly said they weren't going to support him, just as Kasich is saying now. And of course, he did lose a landslide. But it should note that it kind of blazed the trail. Some of the factors that he reached out to, for example, the White South, became keystones in the Republican coalition that was subsequently built by Nixon and by Reagan and lasted for a long time. So that's the question we have for Trump. Is he going to be Reagan or a Goldwater? But in any case, whatever he's got here, his impact on American politics is profound, and I believe will continue to be profound. Let me finally say something about Brexit. You know, one of the reasons I left, as I said earlier, in Britain, is around about 50 years ago, we came to the conclusion that Britain was finished. And one of the reasons for this was we could see this immense elite consensus falling behind the European Union. Subsequently, of course, they finagled Britain into the European Union by a parliamentary procedure. We always felt, those who opposed the European Union, and John Ormond was one of them, that if we could only get a straight-up vote on this thing, a referendum, which of course was unprecedented in British politics at that point, we would win because the opinion polls were so strongly in our favour. And then eventually we did get this referendum in 1973 because Enoch Powell basically threw his weight to the Labour Party because the Labour Party had promised a referendum. Well, then actually having pushed this referendum through, Harold Wilson changed sides and supported staying in, and the Tories supported staying in, and the Liberals supported staying in, the BBC supported staying in, and the University supported staying in, and the Archbishop of Canterbury supported staying in, everybody supported staying in, and it worked. They were able to turn opinion around, briefly. So it was like the Goldwater election, actually. The elite was able to anathematise the alternative. Then, of course, the opinion polls probably went back to where they were before, with the European Union being massively unpopular. And it continued that way for what, 43 years? Now, the fascinating thing about Brexit was that exactly the same coalition formed against the Brexit vote, and it really looked like it was going to work for them. But it didn't work. In the intervening 43 years, it seems to me, judging from a distance, you know, the British have become substantially disillusioned with their ruling class. And it simply could not put this thing across what it thought it was going to be able to. That's what's happened in America too. The rank and file Republicans have acquired a total contempt for their own leadership, let alone the Democrat Party leadership. So as I say, the moral of the story is that things that can't go on forever don't. And I think there is some hope that the US will not in the end see its founding population going to a minority because of vigorous executive action. If it does go into a minority, of course, the country will break up. America, as we know it, will be finished. But I'm afraid that's probably the case in Britain too. Is that enough, Lucia? How long did I talk for? About 20 minutes.
Yeah, is it okay we come with some questions?
Yes.
Sure. If you want to ask questions, you can just get close to the computer and ask there.
Hello. You said that you thought that a treacherous elite wanted to remake Europe, also America, and that there were reasons for that. Perhaps you could say a bit more about that.
I mean, it's one of the great mysteries. It's not just in America, it's also in Britain. And that puts a very different cast on it, because it's obviously something very deeply felt among the elite. I think one issue is what I call the alienation, Hitler's revenge. I think that the entire American elite emerged from the Second World War so traumatized by the experience of fighting Nazism They went overboard the other way. And they convinced themselves eventually that any expression of ethno-nationalism, any expression of national identity is racism and has to be stamped out. But there's awful people, the guy Peter Sutherland, do you know him?
Oh, unfortunately, yes.
Well, I mean, he's very explicit about it. He says that the European Union's member states cannot be allowed to have an ethnic identity, and he's also, so he's written a column, he wrote a column some years ago, regretting the fact that the Arab Spring was a missed opportunity because the chance existed to weave together both sides of the Mediterranean, which of course they're now doing through the Syrian influx. There's something really bizarre going on here. And I think you can explain part of it by corruption and so on, but I think also there's some type of an ideological hegemony that anti-racism has, which is why I like to point out that what's really at stake here is treason. I mean, some years ago I wrote an article about a book that was published in Britain about their an oral history of people who lived through the Second World War, both the soldiers on the home front. And the overwhelming consensus among these people when they're interviewed is that it wasn't worth it. And that's certainly not my own parents' thought. They're now long dead, but my father was 4.5 years in North Africa with the Royal Engineers. And by the end of his life, when he died in 1990, he just come to the conclusion it was totally wasted. That appears to be treason. If somebody who is prepared to make that kind of a sacrifice thinks it wasn't worth it, something's gone very badly wrong. Yeah.
Okay, I have a question. What I want to ask is, we have a corrupt, treacherous elite. I very much doubt they can be reformed or woken up because they know what they're doing. That means we have to create a new elite. Now, so my question is two parts. How do we create a new elite to replace the corrupt, treacherous one? And are there enough people already on the scene, people like Trumps waiting in the wings, or people like David Duke perhaps? Or do we have to create, you know, how much of it is getting people already there, just bringing them out of the shadows, or creating a new elite? And what chance do you think David Duke has down in that in the south?
Well, to answer that last question first, I really don't know about Duke. I've never understood. But, I mean, he basically did his very best to reinvent himself as a conservative nationalist, and he was simply never allowed to come in from the cold. It's very odd that, you know, the British in Britain, for example, we have cabinet officials who were former Communist Party members like Mendelssohn and Dennis Healy before him, and that's okay. But it's not okay for David Duke, or whatever else you think about him, was never serving the interests of foreign power. I don't know. It strikes me he could do well in Louisiana, but I don't know why he's been out of politics for so long. And I suspect that may be something to do with his personality and his personal life. He hasn't seemed to make the full-hearted commitment to it that you would expect. Now, more generally, about 18 months ago, I did a debate at the American Renaissance Conference in Tennessee, and John Derbyshire and I, also English, were on the side that, you know, this could all be solved. The electoral politics shouldn't give up on the political process. This was before Trump declared. Nobody had the least idea that Trump was going to declare. The overwhelming consensus then was that Jeb Bush was going to be the nominee. And of course, he would have moved immediately to amnesty. But we said that, things turn up. You never know what's going to turn up. And we were old enough to remember the Reagan, the late 1970s, when things looked extremely dark. We really did think that the Soviet Union was going to take over the world. I remember Bill Rusher, the publisher of National Review, saying to me in 78 that he thought it all was lost. Last chance to turn everything around was when Reagan ran in 76 against Ford, and that he could have won, but he didn't. And that red flag was one day going to wave over the world. This is after the fall of Vietnam. This is what American conservative intellectuals privately thought at that time. But he said, you know, we keep on, we persevere, because on the one hand, you never know what's going to turn up. And on the other hand, which is a Clausewitzian injunction, by the way, it's in Clausewitz on war, you never know what's going on the other side of the hill. So that's why you should never surrender. And his other point was, well, there were theological injunctions against despair. Russia was a very serious Anglo-Catholic. So we said, you know, we never know, it could happen, because Reagan did turn it all around in a very short period of time. Now, the problem we've got is that, you know, nobody under the age of 35 really believes in that the Cold War was serious. So the younger generation, they remember Reagan vague as this avuncular, vague, probably half senile figure. And they don't take him seriously. But in fact, he was a fierce partisan who had a number of very big ideas, just as Trump does. Trump is running actually a very high concept campaign. He has very sweeping ideas about how he's going to change American foreign policy and so on. Well, we argued we could be turned around, and the other side was simply apocalyptical. Richard Spencer and Sam Dixon, they thought we're just going to have to take the hills, and the conventional parties simply couldn't handle it. I think it's obvious from Trump that it is possible special parties could have this. In terms of the personnel, I'm very struck with the number of young people who have just literally gathered themselves together in the teeth of this intense political correctness that we see now in the US. And I say it reminds me very much of the American conservative movement when I first moved to the U.S. in 1970. There's a real burgeoning of underground of activity in the catacombs, basically. Now, of course, it won. The conservative movement won. It elected Reagan, and then it went bad. But nothing grows to the sky. You just have to start all over again.
Hi. I'm somewhat of the token American of the group here, and I was interested in some of your ideas on the Republican Party, and I was wondering if you thought the rise of Trump sort of signaled a return to the sort of Rockefeller Republican pre-Goldwater days in terms of domestic policy, or if it's altogether an entirely different beast. If you could elaborate on that.
Right. I mean, you're actually correct that in many respects, Trump is a moderate Republican. He doesn't seem to be wholeheartedly committed to fighting the battle on abortion or against homosexual marriage and all this kind of thing. And he doesn't even bother to lie about it. He doesn't even mention them in his speech, but in his convention speech. But you know, what Trump is, which is actually quite nuanced, is he's a nationalist. And I don't think that the division between the conservative movement on the one hand and the Rockefeller Republicans on the other was about nationalism, or at least to the extent that it was. It was the conservatives who were nationalists and wanted to fight the Soviet Union and so on. So I think we're looking at a completely new type of Republican Party, which is focused on quite different issues than the issues that have dominated really sooner since the fall of the Soviet Union. It's hard to see which way it's going to go. In Connecticut, where are you from, my dear?
I'm from New York, from New York City.
Okay, well, if you know Connecticut, you know the Greenwich and the coastal suburbs near New York are a hotbed of liberal republicanism.
Yes.
The state itself is substantially a white and blue collar state, but there's some very wealthy people down there. Up here in Litchfield County, we're practically on the Massachusetts line. It's a white opium, and again, to the extent that they have political opinions at all, they tend to be very moderate Republicans. But Trump swept more,
yeah.
And he swept also the Naugatuck Valley and all the blue collar areas in Connecticut. He was able to establish somehow. Somehow he was able to establish connections with all these people right across the board, so that people who would not normally be voting together were voting together. And it's mysterious. I mean, Trump's a revolution not merely in terms of his politics, but also in terms of his technique. I mean, one of the reasons why I think conservative objects to him so strongly is that he's shown at all this apparatus of polling and speechwriters and I mean, just write speeches, he gets up and extemporizes, which is unheard of in American politics. And he doesn't even do it particularly well, by the way. I mean, if compared to how British parliamentary performance can operate. And above all, he's not spending money on television advertising. Now, of course, that's part because he's a cheap Scotchman, actually. But it turns out that, you know, you don't need that stuff. I mean, Bush, Cruz, and Rubio, all of them spent more than $100 million on their campaigns. And they got nothing for it. Trump spent maybe $30 million. It's extraordinary. It's a revolution in technique. And of course, that's a big problem for the people in Washington who make a living off this. And that's one reason why they're so bitter for it. It's new what's happened. It's a new party's emerging. And I don't know whether the country club faction, as we call it, will stay in it or whether it migrate over to Democrat. Because Wall Street is now a Democratic stronghold.
Right, right.
Does that make sense to you? What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think I agree with you on a lot of those points. I see somewhat of a move towards this sort of, you know, pre-Goldwater Republican Party, but at the same time, I think it's more unifying in the way that you were mentioning across the party. I think, you know, the sort of liberal Republicans are going to be sort of pushed off the edge into the Democratic Party. I see that they're already coalescing around, you know, Hillary in that way, and I think that's pretty spot on from my observation.
You know, I think it's important to recognize also that the Democrats have coalition problems too. I mean, if you look at this, basically what's happened with Democrats is they're about to tip.
Into two major, if not more, factions, I believe so.
Right. I mean, the Sanders insurrection was quite clearly a white leftist lunatic. And what put Clinton over was basically corrupt minority machines. So the two of them fought it out. Here in Connecticut, Sanders carried the white vote, the white Democratic vote in Connecticut. He lost because of the Democratic machines in the big urban areas. In Indiana, it's the other way around. Sanders had carried the white vote. That was enough for him to win. That's going to be a hard thing to hold together. I mean, if you look at the Democratic Party, in the last general election, somewhere about just over 50% of the Democratic vote was white. All the rest were minorities. That white group is also somewhat problematic because probably about 2 or 3% of them are Jewish. The Jews vote in overwhelmingly Democratic, and a fair bunch of them, we don't know how many, are probably homosexuals, you know, because they're what, 2% of the population. They appear to vote equally heavily Democratic. So it's like a housing project. The Democratic Party is on the point of tipping because what we find in the U.S. is that, you know, you can't run. When you get past a certain point, whites just leave. And I think that could very easily happen to the Democratic Party. It's going to be, for example, they're going to want progressive policies on taxation, redistribution, and so on. And that's going to be kind of hard for these people like John Kasich and so on, who are moderate Republicans, to stand still for. They're going to find themselves in a party that wants to tax them a lot more than they want to be taxed. So they have problems too, the Democrats.
I think they have even more problems, I would say.
Right. Because what they're doing is an old solution. I mean, they've not come up with a new formula yet.
Right.
We'll see if it works. If they lose the white working class, and it's widely agreed that Trump is appealing to the white working class in an unprecedented way, they're in very serious trouble.
Yeah.
Given that the Conservative and Labour parties, which have dominated British politics for as long as most of us can remember, were solidly behind the Remain campaign, after the great Brexit victory, there seems to be some sort of a vacuum or rather an opportunity in British politics, but no one seems to have come forward to really take the country in a new direction. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I agree there's a vacuum there, just as there's been a vacuum in American politics. I guess my only thought is things that can't go on forever don't. So something will happen. It's surprisingly hard. It's very hard to get new parties and so on moving in a parliamentary system. But it can be done. I've seen it done in Canada. I was in Canada about 10 years after I got out of Stanford. And, you know, the Progressive Conservative Party succeeded in alienating its base, and it was eventually replaced by a Western-based party, Reform. So, and similarly, in Quebec, the Liberals were basically trying to play both sides against the middle on the nationalist issue in Quebec, the sovereignist issue in Quebec. And for a long time it worked, and then this was replaced by the Bloc Québécois, which is now a right separatist party. So it can happen, and when it happens very suddenly. Mm. So don't despair.
No.
Hello, Peter. You write on financial subjects that you've mentioned. It's clear to many of us who follow financial affairs that we are heading towards yet another periodically occurring financial crisis. How do you see this impacting on the condition of America, and especially if we do suffer a serious financial dislocation this time, more serious than 2008? Do you think that's going to cause civil strife, racial conflict, etc.? Thank you.
You know, I don't really see any easy way out of this financial, this hole that the GOPs are in financially, economically. I mean, growth is very slow in the US. I think Obama is the first president who never had GDP growth of above 3% in his 8-year period in office. And wages really are stagnant, so on. But on the other hand, they've already tried priming the pump and vastly expanding national debt, so it's not easy to see any way out. There's a lot of ruin in the country, though, and I think if Trump is elected, we would see things. I mean, at the moment, everybody here thinks it's like 1968 when the cities were in flames and there were riots everywhere and all that kind of thing. And it's a great mystery that after Nixon was elected in 68, it all went away. There were no more major riots in the cities. He didn't even have to go and massacre anybody. It just went away. I think that if Trump is elected, we may see the same thing. I think the Black Lives Matter movement, which is fundamentally a democratic racket designed to increase turnout, I think it will evaporate and we'll have a surprising period of quiet.
Another question.
Yeah.
I must say, you know, it's true that I was a financial journalist for many years. Well, about 3 years, and latterly, I was a columnist for MarketWatch, which is a free site run by the Wall Street Journal. But about 3 years ago, I lost that column. And the reason I lost it was simply because the enforcers here got so savage. Although I never wrote about political issues on MarketWatch, the fact, and I was purely about technical, highly technical financial matters, the fact that I also was known to be there, and make an argument for immigration was enough for the various enforcers throughout the Southern Poverty Law Center and so on to demand that I be fired. And ultimately that they got the way. It was too embarrassing for them to have me around. Now I'm sufficiently old and VDare.com is sufficiently well established that I didn't care. But for younger people in journalism, it's extremely difficult. And the reign of terror is getting much more intense than it was even 15 years ago. I think the reason for that is that the left knows quite consciously in the US that they're very, very close to achieving a minority majority in the US. Just another 10 or 15 years and they'll have the numbers. The majority of births in the US are non-white now and have been now for 4 or 5 years. So they're desperate for that tissue coming into politics. And that means the hysteria that you see that they're directing against Trump. And also the various witch hunts that they launch against anybody else who raises who they think it might possibly raise these issues. I'm sorry.
So, as a person of the left, I'd first of all say how confused I am by your continued identification of the Democrat Party with the left. They seem to me to be pretty firmly on the centre, or the right, as we in Britain would normally see them. I'm interested in this word that was picked up by a few people who questioned you as well. They mentioned the treacherous elite that you talked about. And I just wonder, to what is the treachery? Where is the treachery? I mean, you're someone who has kind of a background in Britain. You said at some stage you thought Britain was through. Some stuff to do with the European Union. Was it workers' rights you were interested in protecting? In the same way that Anthony Ben Wedgwood or Jeremy Corbyn in his youth were interested? Or what is it exactly that you're interested in preserving or conserving? They said that you're a paleo-conservative. Is it just these kind of strange ethnic nation states that only kind of cropped up about 130 years ago? Or, I mean, what precisely is your, what is it you're trying to conserve? What is it you feel is being betrayed? That's what I'd like to know. I walked out of the talk when you called the Jewish portion of the Democratic vote problematic. I went outside and I had to calm down. I found that completely beyond the pale. I'm very happy to have the opportunity that I'm on camera in your talk to say that, because to just sit through that was really sickening. But if you can answer my question, then we can leave that.
In that case, what I mean by problematic in the case of the Jews is that, and American Jews, is that they are very firmly on the left, and they are systematically different in their beliefs and preferences than the non-Jewish white population.
So that's what I'd like to know. What is it that you're preserving then? You're preserving something that's cropped up historically, contingently, for a certain group of people who all moved to America, as we famously know, blah, 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 from England. So what are you trying to conserve? And why is the word paleo in your biography, which I think of as referring to things that are very old, not things that are 150 years old?
Of course, nation states actually date back a lot further than that. I mean, the English monarchy has been around a long time. Let me just go to another one of your points about the Democrats.
I'd like to say I'm not interested so much in the Democrats as I'm interested in what your ontology is here. I had a lot to get off my chest after your talk, so I had to say a little bit of it, as much for the benefit of the people here, because I can't just sit by, in a sense, and be a passive listener. But okay, yes, please talk. Democrats and your ontology, what are the things you want to preserve?
In the case of the Democrats, I just said that Democrats are going to have trouble holding the coalition together. And one of the reasons is that there's a left-wing faction there which is extremely dissatisfied with the way the party's been run. Very similar to the conservative faction, extremely dissatisfied with the way the Republican Party's been run. But the fact is they are the party of the left in America, in as far as there is a party, and the Republicans are the party of the right. But in both cases, I think to partisans, very unsatisfactory. Paleoconservatism was a movement that started... was identified in the 1990s in opposition to neoconservatism, which was a movement of ex-liberals who came into the Republican Party and whose principal interests are foreign policy and intervention and the Iraq war and so on. So that was the term. Now, paleoconservatism is now almost extinct as a term, and it just happens to hang around in Wikipedia because they never revise it. The term that you would see now is alt-right, or we use the term distant right. The problem with all these terms is that they get too identified with particular factions. In the case of the paleoconservatives, it's very identified with a magazine called Chronicles, which is a very fiercely Catholic magazine and is hostile to free markets and so on. And to that extent, you know, it's a misnomer. I'm not a Catholic, and I still linger in sympathy for free markets. Although I must say, the young people I deal with don't. They're completely fed up with libertarianism. Now, what I'm conserving is the nation state. That's what the national question is. That's what we're focused on. Can America survive as a nation state, the expression of a particular people? And it's quite wrong to imagine that America is a creation of immigration. It's a creation of settlement. I'm afraid I just have to live through this phone number. The great wave of immigrants that arrived by the Tang Revolution developed as an organic nation, very much as England did, and really until the 1890s that was still the case. It was a very large British country. When they discovered that immigration was taking the country away from them before, they cut it off in the 1920s, and they were quite explicit about it. They said, this is a country that benefits us, our people, the purpose of, as it says in the Declaration of Independence, the purpose is to benefit ourselves and our posterity, you know. They meant posterity literally. So my question is, you know, the question we have to feed there is, has immigration reached the point where the US can no longer function as a nation state? And the answer is damn close to it. And again, I think you're completely wrong to imagine that. Are you seriously arguing that there was no nation state in Britain?
No, I don't seriously argue this, but I argue it as sort of something that kind of, you know, in terms of that becoming kind of, that becomes then this kind of idea that's, I mean, just to go back to the point that you're saying, like, can America no longer function as a nation state? Okay, fine, we can say about the dates, like in Britain it happened here, in Germany it happened here, or in Italy with unification or whatever. We all read Benedict Anderson on the left, and then I'm sure you on the right have your favorite references that will be a different reading list. But I'm interested in why you want to preserve it so much, or what, like, at one stage it sounded like you were saying some stuff like, you're from the north, you left England because you thought it's through it. It seemed to have to do with workers' rights. That seemed really interesting to me. I'm interested in, because of what's happened in Brexit, yes, we have, just on the left, we have a very obvious thing where the left in Britain was opposed to EU membership because they believed it would create the reserve army of labor that Marx talked about. And in some ways, we've seen evolutions of that idea in particular political situations. But if you're not interested in workers' rights or anything like that, and you're only interested in these spooky kind of imaginary objects, then I'm just not interested. I mean, you need to tie it to something better.
Sure, immigration destroys workers' rights, doesn't it? Drives wages down.
I'm not talking about whether it does that or not.
Can we?
Yes, we'll take
it.
Thank you for your answer. Thank you.
I specifically said that I come to the conclusion that the conservative movement in the US in the last 10 years or 15 years had become a racket, and that it was basically cloaking an attack by capitalists on the living standards of the working class. I specifically said that.
You said that, but is that what you're interested in fighting against, or is that what you're trying to conserve?
I think it's all part of a package for me. I do think that the nation state is a very important thing that human beings absolutely need, just as they need families. And they're not going to be able to survive. Civilization depends on certain things, and one of them is the nation state. One of the problems with Hitler's revenge and World War II is that people have lost sight of that. And that is why we see these vast multinational empire developing in Europe, and the Americans are trying to do it too. I mean, these trade agreements that they keep forming, if you look at them, they're not really about trade. They're about giving up my national sovereignty and having all the various nation states that are tied up in the nation in these things hand over their sovereignty to unelected elected bureaucrats for all kinds of reasons. And I don't like that either. As I say, I think it's all part of a package. In the end, we do need identity and community, and the nation state is the best way we've discovered to provide that.
Do you believe that perhaps the destruction of what you term as the nation state and the continued consolidation of what we traditionally understand as nations into large agglomerations is part of a globalist, finance-led, that is to say the financial, international financial elite, that it is in fact in pursuit of their agenda of a one world global debt slavery system?
I mean, when you see people like Peter Sutherland testifying before the House of Lords that the European Union member states cannot be allowed to be ethnically specific, they have to be multicultural, multiracial, you'd really have to wonder what's going on. Yes. So, to some extent, I think, you know, paranoids have enemies, and the stuff that the John Bernstein used to go on about the Bilderbergers and so on, there's a shred of truth in it. There is people do seem to want to organise the globe in a way that's I would regard as anti-democratic, and indeed anti, for that matter, anti-working class, because it's not going to benefit them. So as I get older, I incline towards more paranoia, is what it comes down to.
Yes, I mean, it's not really conceivable, is it, that the political power and financial power are two separate entities? I mean, that would be really, when it comes to it, an inconceivable situation, realistic, would it not?
Well, I agree. I mean, I think it's a very weird situation, and you know, they've been able to do things which I wouldn't have thought possible in terms of the European Union and so on. That they've been able to persuade national political classes to give up their authority to a non-elected bureaucracy. It's really bizarre. It's really bizarre. Of course, in many of the European Union member states, you do people who don't have a tradition of self-government, and much of a tradition of self-government and democracy anyway, for various tragic reasons. But that's not the case with Britain. Anyway, go ahead.
Please.
Okay, well, I think it's talking about which of
political politically correct witch hunts and hysteria against people occurs both on the left. Jeremy Corbyn and Ken Livingstone suffer from it, and on the right, Donald Trump. Now, in America, you have tradition of free speech, free debate, free discussion. And in Britain and Europe, it is what we can say or do is shrinking very fast, if you want to keep your job, that is. Now, if you're wealthy, or if you have a political position like Corbyn or Livingstone, you're on a radio show, then you're okay. But what about if you aren't wealthy, or you haven't got a secure job, you know? What then? How do you cope with weathering this politically correct tyranny that tries to force its views on you? That's my question.
I must say, I mean, I've been out of Britain for a long, long time now, but from what I can see, the situation there is really quite horrible. Do any of you know Sean Gack?
Yeah.
Okay, but I talked to him about this, and he happily refers to Britain as a police state. And it seems fairly apparent that he's right in many respects. And I guess the answer to that is you just have to go to the catacombs. The problem is that they're looking in the catacombs, you know, they're working with Facebook to track people down, as we've seen in Germany. So, we think we have it bad here, and in some respects we do, but I think the situation in Britain and Europe generally, where you actually have the force of law against you, is really quite horrifying. And you're in a better situation than I am to tell me what you can do about it.
Well, we're facing a situation here in Britain where Cameron has made it clear that there's going to be... can you hear me okay?
I can hear you, yes.
You can hear me, okay. That there's going to be laws on non-violent extremists, and that includes people who say that 9/11, for instance, was an inside job and was basically a Mossad operation, and things of that kind. He's going to make these things, basically it's illegal to have such opinions into broadcasting.
Right. I have a friend here who's a member, in fact, invented the term alternative right, Richard Spencer, runs Ravens, and he's apparently been banned from Britain now by Theresa May. I mean, she was the one who signed the letter that he got. When she was Home Secretary. I mean, he's never advocated violence. He's never been violent, you know, and yet they apparently feel they can't let him in, which strikes me as astonishing, and it's a great condemnation of the conservative intellectual class that apparently won't stand up and protest about this kind of thing.
I'll come closer because I can't. So
in the States, I'm interested in your ideas on immigration and sort of how it fits into American conservatism. I found that although I'm fairly young conservative in the U.S., that the most prominent thinkers, not including myself, but you know, people that I admire their thought, are actually children of immigrants, people of color, with this sort of new conservative ideas, and that. You know, I was wondering if you saw any optimism in immigration sort of, fueling the sort of, conservatism in a way that I think you and I maybe agree on this and sort of talking about workers' rights, so on and so forth. I found that in my circles in New York and California, coming from this sort of very liberal background, that it sort of engendered this very forward-thinking sort of conservatism, and what I find is it's actually
you know, this traditional demographic of, you know, maybe white, you know, Protestant Americans that sort of take up this politically correct, dogmatic ideology and traditionally with the left, and that I found in my circle that the best conservative thinkers were children of immigrants, like not myself, but I am, you know, a first generation American. So right. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that.
You know, I run VDare.com as a forum site. It's not actually, I don't view it as a conservative site. I'll let anybody publish on it who has something, some criticism right. or to make of current immigration policy. And we do have readers, you know, and even writers and donors from every ethnic group. And, you know, for example, we just ran an article by a Mexican-American woman about how much she hates the influx of illegal aliens into her community in Arizona. You know, and she wants to know, why did my parents come here if Mexico's going to follow us? So I mean, you do find people who are open to this kind of argument in every racial group, in every walk of life. I think you were saying that the American WASPs are pretty well intellectually degenerate. And I was thinking that I agree with that. I think that there's no real tradition of WASP intellectual life here anymore, because all the institutions, they've lost control of all their institutions.
I've seen this in generations of Yalies in Connecticut, so exactly, as you described it.
Right. You find a lot of them are simply very happy to move over to the life in New York City, for example. I mean, my brother's wife was a descendant of a New Hampshire Yankees who came down to New York, and were obviously at one point complete thugs and robber barons. But by the 1980s, they were all God-fearing Democrats and very afraid of any kind of political correctness and so. And that's a really interesting question that came about. On the other hand, you know, this is a very, very deep country, and there's all kinds of intellectual currents going on out there that's come swirling to the surface. That's surprising. So you know, maybe they just need the WASPs, the Protestants just need new leadership. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, somewhat. Thank you.
Well, try again.
I don't know. I was wondering if you see any optimism in immigration in sort of like a generation down, sort of this, you know, because America, I think it's a little bit antiquated to think about, you know, who arrived on the Mayflower. We sort of make fun of our friend that, you know, whose parents did, because it's such an antiquated idea of an American, what an American nation is. I think that, you know, undoubtedly we are a nation of immigrants, and that is why, you know, why I feel people, even on the left, should fear American nationalism. I think American nationalism is not very, you know, scary, because it is, in fact, not a nation of any specific people.
I don't agree that America is a nation of immigrants. I argue this in my book, and so does Ann Coulter in her book, Adios America, by the way, which in many respects is an update in the Bible that came out last year. It's a nation, you could argue it's a nation of settlers. But it's actually an organic community that grew here over a very long period of time, 300 or 400 years. It's faster than the nations of Europe, but it's the process is obviously very similar. It's fundamentally similar. And the question is whether that can be undone as quickly as it was put together. I think you might have been asking whether I saw hope for conservatism or yeah. nationalism or whatever among immigrants. And the answer is, in general, yes. I mean, it's not uncommon. We get articles and letters from immigrants all the time who are deeply unhappy about the current situation. And they're not as, they don't have these romantic illusions about immigration that American intellectuals tend to have. Well, the problem with racially diverse societies is what Lee Kuan Yew, you know, the founder of modern Singapore, said some years ago. In an interview with Der Spiegel, he said, you know, when you have racially divided societies, every election becomes a referendum on what tribe you belong to. Right. And political principles and arguments and so on ultimately go by the board. It's always a question of expressing racial solidarity. very, very hard to make democracy and liberal institutions work over a deeply racially divided society.
Right.
In fact, basically can't be done.
Well, given that, given what you just said is a view that many here would agree with, the question arises, as it always does, cui bono? Who benefits from all this? We can see that maybe newcomers benefit in the short term at least, but well-established immigrant groups certainly don't benefit from it any more than white groups, unless they are ethno-nationalists and have some kind of agenda. Then they may do. So the question is, cui bono?
I think that we ran an article about 14 or 15 years ago by a writer called Steve Saylor that we have, and he was discussing George W. Bush, and he went into great detail about the Bush's relationships with the Mexican oligarchs, which is really interesting because, of course, from time to time, these Mexican oligarchs were either shot or finish up in jail or have to flee the country and things like that. But he came to the conclusion that the Bush family in Texas really did admire these Mexican oligarchs and the way they lived. And they fundamentally wanted to transform the US into that kind of a society. A society where there's a great number of poor people and a small number of very wealthy people living in gated communities, which I guess you could say is also the case in Brazil. And I think that it's quite clear that like, considerable portions of the American 1%, really do think that that's the best way to live. They think they can completely insulate themselves from whatever the problems are. And at the same time, it's a great source of cheap labour, cheap servants, and all this kind of thing. And it's very, very hard to get them past that. A couple of years ago, I was having a conversation with a man who founded one of the great brokerage firms in on Wall Street in the 1960s. And he was telling us that, well, he owned a ranch in Texas, which, as I said earlier, is where my wife is from. And he said, we have to have these illegal immigrants because if we don't have these illegal immigrants, I can't operate my ranch. Can't get Americans to do this kind of work. Well, of course, to me this says, why are you paying them more? And if the ranch is, if you can't afford to pay these people more, maybe it shouldn't be there in the first place. But what I actually said to him was, well, these illegal immigrants that come in and their families and so on, which way did they vote? And this question never occurred to him. It literally never occurred to him. He said, well, why should I care which way they vote? And I think the answer to the question is that they're going to vote for the left, and the left is going to dispossess him. But they haven't made this connection. They continue to believe that they can insulate themselves.
Sorry, which of the illegal immigrants are voting?
I beg your pardon?
Which of the illegal immigrants are voting?
No, I said the families. The children will vote.
Right,
okay. Because of the misinterpreted 40th Amendment. I think there's a fair amount of voter fraud, by the way. That goes on.
Yes, but exactly, with stopping all of the black communities being able to vote and so on and so on. We all know it's very, very famous. There's a tremendous amount of voter fraud going on in America.
I don't think it's what you meant.
I assume it's what you meant because you keep having these sort of like closet left-wing fantasies that farms should just pay their workers good wages.
I can't quite hear what you say. I just
imagine that you have this fantasy where farms pay their workers good wages, which seems to me like a left-wing thing, but I don't understand where this... I mean, let's just agree to call it off, because I really don't have the energy.
I've got a question. It seems to me...
It's just a question of supply and demand. If you increase the supply of labour, you're going to beat down the prices. If you tighten up the labour market, it's going to increase wages. That's all there is to it.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I've got a similar sort of linked into that somehow. It seems to me there's two forces in the world today. On the one side, you've got globalization, which wants a sort of materialist, neocon, one world slave state, where people are interchangeable, they can move people from country to around place, people without identity, without culture, tradition, religion, family, community, right? That's the one side, globalization.
Yeah.
On the other side, you have identity, and this is like a non-materialist desire to assert things that aren't materialist, aren't money. So you have the Kurds wanting independence, the Transdniestrians want recognition for their country, the Tuaregs, Tibetans, Quebec, Scottish, Basques. You've got an increase in separatism and tribalism. Not the old nation states that were mentioned there, but even older nation states, shall we say, ethnic groups, tribal groups. So you've got globalization versus identity. That's the way I see it. Now, my question is very simple. Who is going to win?
Well, I'm betting on identity. And that's why I've been running this website for nearly 20 years now at enormous annoying an awful lot of people who I used to be very friendly with. So I guess I'm betting that identity will win. But I must say, I mean, it's going to be a close run thing here, because the historic American nation is going to lose control of its state, basically. And then what? How does it find expression?
Will America divide into separate countries? Will you have a Mexican, like, will Texas become Mexico La Raza type thing?
I think it's entirely possible that America will break up. These different parts of the country are going to be as different as any different parts of the world. They're going to be speaking different languages, they're going to be different races. What I think should happen first is the Americans need to redefine their states. The states originally represented specific communities, but now, and in some cases that's still it's true, but if you look at a state like California, it's quite obviously too diverse. There's a very substantial sort of rural area of California that's really part of the Midwest, but it's outvoted by the cities on the coast. That's true in a lot of American cities. Illinois, for example. If you go down to southern Illinois, or even mid-central Illinois, it's like a different world from Chicago, where Chicago calls the shots. And so in a sense, those people are colonies of these big cities. I think those states should be broken up, and it would actually help a lot to ease the tensions that the Americans have inflicted on themselves through immigration policy. Big problem then, of course, is what happens when you have the federal government making transfer payments from one area to another in various ways through the federal tax system. And will the areas that have been taxed stand still for it? And it's very problematic, I think. They're taking a lot of risks with the political structure here.
Can I mobilise a couple of different theories that are doing the rounds? And one is that the root cause of the present situation in both America and Europe is the product of Jewish Talmudist supremacist ideology, and of course the financial power that the Jewish community quite clearly had. The other is that we're suffering from a kind of organic Spenglerian decline, which is natural and inevitable. Which one do you think holds more water, if either?
Oh, I'm just thinking, it's more than 50 years since I read Spengler. It is an explanation that, in some ways, is very attractive. You feel the tremendous dead weight of history sometimes. But as I say, these societies are capable of remarkable reinventions from time to time, as I think the US did under Reagan. So Enoch Powell gave this wonderful speech about England, in which he compared it after the collapse of the St. George's Day speech. Have any of you ever read it? I reposted it on our site. He said that, you know, in the 1950s, it was now time to recognise that the British Empire had gone. It was very, very hard for people of his age to recognise that, because they were present at its highest peak in the Second World War. But it had gone, and something had to replace it. And he compared the situation to the situation that the Athenians found when they came back to Athens after Salamis, and found that, of course, the temples are all in burden and so on, but the sacred olive tree was still intact. And he said, we need to guard that stock, because we don't know what kind of shoots that is going to put forward. And that's basically how I feel about nation states. You don't know what they're capable of doing next. Now, in answer to the question about the Jews, which I will address head on, particularly the US, this is a huge and interesting question, because, you know, we're about 2-3% of the population is Jewish. It's immensely influential, I think it's not unreasonable to say it has displaced, for example, the WASP and the Ivy League. The Ivy League is now basically Jewish institutions, looking at the numbers. But on the other hand, you know, Trump's chief speechwriter, who wrote his convention speech at Church, Steve Miller. So you find them on all sides of every question. Whereas right now, there's no doubt that the great bulk of Jewish opinion in the media and so on is against Trump. You do find people who are in favour of him. I don't know which way it's going to break down. I'm sure you're familiar with the work, or maybe you're familiar with the work of Kevin MacDonald, the Cultural Critique. I run articles from MacDonald from time to time because I think he has a good argument. I mean, I think he makes a good rational argument and he's worth exploring. The first one we ran was whether or not the neoconservatives could be regarded as a Jewish movement. And he discussed this, and he said on balance he thought it was fair to say they were a Jewish movement. But there's also this was that we were immediately named a hate group by the Southern Baptist Center. That's not because they didn't cite him, they had no particular reason for it. And at that point, all of our mainstream media contacts, which were substantial, immediately dried up. So I guess that's really an example of power. Every major Jewish organization was in favor of amnesty. Now, it doesn't poll all that well among Jews. You can certainly find, I have Jewish writers, we have Jewish donors. You can certainly find all kinds of Jews who don't agree with that. But the Jewish establishment was very firmly in favor of mass immigration, and I don't see that it's going to change. I don't expect, somewhere between 60 and 80% of Jews vote for the left, vote Democratic. I don't see that's going to change. We used to think it was going to change. We used to think it was going to change in 1980 when a substantial number of voted for Reagan. But it turned out to be a phenomenon. It evaporated.
Several years ago, a lot of people seemed to think that religion was a dead force in the world, but now it seems possibly it will be the stronger force, the strongest force in the next century. Well, what's your views about that, how it might shape the future of Britain and America?
You're completely correct about that. I mean, when I was a kid growing up in England in the 1960s, you know, the conventional wisdom about the Arab world was that Arab socialism was the way of the future. It was a totally secular society, Islam was completely finished. This turned out to be wrong. I think it's, it may well prove to be wrong in Europe as well. And Christendom may well reinvent itself. It doesn't look pretty hopeless right now, but you never know. One of my other favourite themes, which I occasionally talk about in the talks I give on PDR, is that miracles happen quite often in politics. We just don't realise it. I mean, the Soviet Union collapsed. Nobody expected the Soviet Union to collapse.
Yeah.
Similarly, nobody expected the Afrikaners to give up control of their nation state, but they did. And certainly nobody expected Donald Trump to come on the scene. And talking to professional politicians is actually the worst possible way to guess what's going to happen in the future. Because they're kind of like blind shrews, you know. They have exquisitely sensitive noses. They rush around, sniffing their way to whatever's going to benefit in the next minute or 2 minutes, and they get really mad if you talk about what's going to happen next day or next week. And that's why it is that, you know, in the 1970s when I was first in America, they all won the consensus with where wage and price controls were necessary. It's a form of socialism, actually, because the state was going to control the price system. You never hear about that anymore. It just totally collapsed. It'll come back, of course. But right now it's gone for good. So, in answer to your question, you know, maybe we can have a religious miracle too. But I must say, as an Episcopalian, I sure don't see it coming from the Anglican Church.
No.
Peter, thank you so much for your time. I think we're going to cut off now.
Okay, Lucia, thanks very much. I hope to come and see you sometime.
Thank you. Again.
Keep in touch.
Yeah, keep in touch.
Bye-bye. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.